WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davey, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross.
Girl, you'll be a woman soon. I love you so much, can't count all the ways I've died for you, girl, and all I can say is, he's not your kind.
Then I saw her face.
That was Urge Overkill, The Four Tops, UB40, Bobby Womack, and Shane McGowan and the Popes. They're all featured on the new CD Forever Neil Diamond, a tribute album of songs by our guest, Neil Diamond. Diamond started out writing songs for a music publishing company in hopes that someone would record them. He wrote the Monkees' number one hit, I'm a Believer. But it was Diamond himself who made most of his own songs famous. Songs like Solitary Man, Cherry Cherry, Sweet Caroline, and Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon. As a lot of his contemporaries fell off the charts, Diamond moved from teen pop to adult pop. He recorded a duet with Barbara Streisand, had hits from his remake of The Jazz Singer, and dressed in spangles for sold-out concerts. In 2005, he recorded a CD of new songs that was intentionally unglitzy. It was produced by Rick Rubin, who recorded Johnny Cash's musically and emotionally naked final albums. Terry spoke with Neil Diamond last year.
I think it's fair to say your first big break, correct me if I'm wrong, was when you had recorded a demo, and the songwriters Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry heard the demo and they really liked you. And they, some of their songs are Do Run Run, Chapel of Love.
Be My Baby.
Be My Baby, yeah. So how did they hear you?
I was making a demo. Usually when you sold a song to a publisher, they would allow you to go in and make your own demo, which was invaluable experience to me. But I went and made the demo and hired Ellie as a backup singer, which she did, despite the fact that she was having huge hits. She liked to sing in the studios with the other girls, and so I hired her for this session, and she liked something about what I was doing, my writing or my singing, and she brought me to her husband, Jeff, and he liked something about what I was doing. I don't know if he liked the writing or the singing, but one liked one, and the other one liked the other. So we started a working relationship. We were both working for the same music publisher, and I kind of got let go by that music publisher, and I asked Jeff and Ellie if they were interested in producing me.
In the first session that you did with them, you recorded Solitary Man. Did you like the idea of horns on this?
I like the idea of anything on those records. I was just thrilled to be there.
Well, let's hear Solitary Man, which I have to say, I think it's really a terrific recording.
Thank you.
Yeah, so, okay, let's hear it. This is your first hit, yes?
Yes,
you recorded yourself. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is Neil Diamond, Solitary Man.
The Linda was mine till the time that I found her, holding Jim, loving him.
him. Then Sue came along, loved me strong, that's what I thought. Me and Sue, that died too. Don't know that I will, but until I can find me a girl to stay, won't play games behind me, and I'll be what I am, a solitary man, solitary man. I've had a day here.
That's Neil Diamond. Now, did you write this song for yourself or for somebody else?
No, I wrote this for myself. I had a contract with Jeff and Ellie, and I started to focus in on just what I wanted to do. And so Solitary Man was written for me and for the first sessions that I was to do with Jeff and Ellie.
There's this like urgency in the song and in the way you sing it. And I think of you in a way as kind of specializing in some of your work in that urgency. Some of the music on your new CD, 12 Songs, too, has that just really urgent sound to it. Is that something you've been conscious of that you think really like works especially well for you as a songwriter and as a singer?
Well, I can tell you that I wasn't conscious of it until you just mentioned it. I've never thought of my songs having that sense of urgency, but I'll listen again and maybe as an objective observer, you can pick up on that stuff. But I never felt that there was an urgency, a sense of drama, a sense of yearning, lots of things, but not urgency. But you may be very right about this. I'm going to listen again now.
So, how did Solitary Man change your idea of what you wanted from your musical life?
Once I had a chart record of my own, I was no longer a kid knocking around on the streets. I was now, we didn't call them artists at that time. We called them vocalists, but I was a vocalist. And it was a whole different thing. I was writing for myself, so I had to really dig in and write as well as I possibly could. And I have to say, before that time, I don't know if I was doing that. I was just writing and writing and writing, maybe just to get an advance from a publisher. But there was not a lot of me in those songs. And Solitary Man was the first of a long line of me songs, my experience songs.
When you were working in the rock and roll Tin Pan Alley, were you actually, and you were writing for music publishers, were you actually going to an office building every day to write?
When I was signed to a staff publishing company, a music company, I would go in as often as I possibly could. The subway train from Brighton Beach, where I live, that took us to New York University, went also a few more stops further to Tin Pan Alley. So there was a lot of cutting of classes, going up and trying to peddle the newest song, probably that I had written in one of the classes at school. And so it was an attraction. It was a seduction that was just a couple of stops beyond NYU. And I unfortunately spent a lot of time skipping that the NYU 8th Street stop and going up to the 49th Street stop, which is where Tin Pan Alley was. And that was great fun, too.
Now, were these several buildings? Was it just the Brill Building or 1620 Broadway also?
Well, 1650 Broadway.
1650, yes, sorry, yeah.
That's all right. Yes, the Brill Building, but there were dozens and maybe hundreds of other music publishing companies in that area in all kinds of buildings. It was that era when rock and roll had just come in, and anybody could get a listening to their music because the publishers didn't understand what rock and roll was, and they were willing to listen to anybody and sign anybody that they thought might have the vaguest chance of having some success. So it was an open game for a number of years. But then things got serious. I got married. I was having a baby on the way, and I had to get serious. Enough with this fun.
Now, the Monkees did a couple of your songs, I'm a Believer and A Little Bit Me, A Little Bit You. Did you write those with them in mind or for yourself? I'm trying to think of what the chronology was. Like, you start recording in, what, like 67?
66.
66, okay. And what year are the Monkees? Like, is that after that?
I think 67, something like that. I had recorded a couple of songs, including Solitary Man and Jerry Jerry, which was a big hit. And because of that hit, the people who were producing the Monkees called and said, we like Cherry Cherry, do you have any other songs? I said, well, I don't have anything like Cherry Cherry, but I have an album coming out soon, and I'll send it over and take your pick.
You know, it's funny, the common wisdom goes when telling the story of, like, songwriters from the Brill Building and the Beatles, is that the Beatles changed everything. After the Beatles, bands started writing their own songs. It drove out the professional songwriters. But, of course, the Monkees are a band that's, you know, a kind of fabricated band copying the Beatles. and you have this tremendous success writing for them. And in that sense, like, the Beatles' success inadvertently really helped you as a songwriter.
Oh, yeah, no question about it. But it was not only in the sense of the Monkees doing a couple of songs. It was in the sense that the doors began to open for songwriters who were able to sing. And I just happened to be one of them who'd been knocking around the streets for years and now suddenly was getting a new and fresh listening to my work. So the Beatles made an enormous change, as did Bob Dylan. They brought the songwriter up to the front of the line and said, you know, you guys do it. And it had a devastating effect on the music publishing business in Tin Pan Alley. But it opened up many doors for people like me.
My guest is Neil Diamond. Here's his version of I'm a Believer.
Meant for someone else, but not for me. Love was out to get me. That's the way it seems. Disappointing, haunted all my dreams. Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer. Not a trace. Couldn't leave her if I tried. I thought love was more or less a given thing.
Neil Diamond. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Neil Diamond. A new tribute album of his songs performed by other artists has just been released. It's called Forever Neil Diamond.
I want to ask you about another of your songs, and this is also an earlier song. It's Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon, and the Urge Overkill version of this was used by Quentin Tarantino in Pulp Fiction. How did you find out that Quentin Tarantino was going to use a version of this song for Pulp Fiction?
Well, first they have to request the right to use it. There's no general license for that. Each one has to be requested and negotiated and either agreed or not agreed on. But I got a request and a part of a script to be used in this movie called Pulp Fiction. And I've always held to a very tenuous line as to what I wanted my songs to be used as. And I wouldn't let them be used in cigarette commercials or alcohol commercials, and this script that I read was way out there. It was beyond what I would turn down normally, and I did turn it down. I heard almost immediately from my publisher, who said, "You know, you shouldn't turn this down. This guy's a tremendous director, and you should just do it and let them do it, which I did. And, of course, I've never regretted it because it was an entirely different way of seeing that song. But that's basically how it happened.
So what did you think of the movie?
Oh, I loved the movie. I was amazed by the movie. I've seen it.
How come you loved the movie but didn't love the script? What was different actually seeing it?
Well, I didn't get the whole script. I only got a few pages of the script in which the song would be used. And I don't know if you remember the scene, but she was, Uma Thurman was very heavily into a coke binge, and she went unconscious and had to be taken for some quote-unquote special treatment. It just seemed too strong for my own taste. And it was a lesson that I learned, you know. See who else is working on it. See how serious they are. Don't take it at face value, and don't take your prejudices into this kind of discussion.
Well, why don't we hear your version of the song? Here it is.
Great.
Girl, you'll be your woman soon. Love so much, can't count all the ways I'd die for you, girl, and all they can say is, he's not your kind. They never get tired of putting me down, and I never know when I come around what I'm gonna find. Don't let them make up your mind. Don't you know, girl, you'll be a woman soon. Please come take my hand. Girl, you'll be a woman soon. Soon
One of the things that has kept you musically successful over the decades is your tours. Would you describe a little bit how you put together your idea of what a show should be?
It's a good question. I've never worked with a director. I like to put the shows together myself with the help of a lot of other people, including the band. My band, who've been with me for many years, and we start right at the beginning. I have a huge blackboard in the studio, and we start with the songs that I want to include and that we haven't included in previous shows. I try to find a good opening song, a good closing song, which is usually, traditionally for me, has been Brother Love's Traveling Salvation Show, because it kind of sums up what I'm about and what I'd like the world to be about. And you fill in and you try to make something interesting, and each song has to have something that's new and fresh and original about it, even if it was written 30 years ago.
What about figuring out what to wear for your shows?
I never thought about it. I have a clothing designer. His name is Bill Whitten. He's been doing my stage clothes for 35 years now. And so I let Bill take the lead in that. I have comments, obviously, things I like and don't like. But Bill handles that, and I think he decided in the mid-70s that he wanted to go with glass beading and sparkly kind of things, basically, I think, because no one else was using it. And it would become mine. So, okay, I tried it, and I think it worked very well, although it's become a point of contention. I mean, just the fact that you bring it up is what has been happening over the years. I'll get a review for a show, and they'll think the show is wonderful, but they'll put down the shirt which is terrific. I'd rather have them put down the shirt than something important. But I've been wearing those kind of shirts, and now it's tapering off now. But the shirts have been part of my persona on stage for as long as I can remember.
Neil Diamond speaking last year with Terry Gross. Here's Neil Diamond from his recent CD, 12 Songs, which was produced by Rick Rubin. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.